Welcome to this episode of the Super Yacht Laundry podcast. I am joined today by the legend. I would like to say that you're a legend. You are one of the most influential women, I would say, in the French Riviera for all the right positive reasons. I'm joined today by the beautiful Lynn Edwin. How are you today, Lynn?
Well, I feel like my head is swelling enormously. I've considered myself maybe a legend for all the wrong reasons of getting into all sorts of naughty scrapes, but I don't know about influential on the French Riviera. But anyway, thank you. What a lovely introduction. Thank you very much.
No, you are. You are. I mean, obviously, you know, you were part of the Pearls of Wisdom story at the beginning. You've done seminars with us. We've done events together. And your role as a trainer, you've just got a beautiful human touch. You know, all of the women in my events have always responded really well. So obviously it makes sense that obviously whatever you were doing before, you ended up training. So yes, great to have you on today. But just to obviously I'm surprised if they're not aware of your existence. Just give us a bit of backstory. What was Lynn doing? What were you doing before yachting came into your life?
Goodness. And when yachting came into my life, I knew absolutely nothing about it. It came into my life quite by chance. So finally, as I was growing up, I always wanted to be a teacher. I always wanted to be a teacher. So I did my O-levels and my A-levels, and I thought I'm going to be a teacher. And I got to the end of my A-levels and I think, oh my word, there must be something more interesting. Because back then, and I'm talking in 1976 when I left school, I could only think of English teacher or history teacher or something like that. And I was thinking, there must be more to life than being a teacher, because I was looking at my English teacher with her bottle glasses and her tweed skirt down to her ankles and all of this sort of stuff. And I thought, that's really not me. What else is on the agenda? So I went down to the school careers office and started to thumb through a few prospectuses and came across hotel management and tourism and catering and all of that sort of stuff. And I always loved cooking. I got the cookery prizes at school and loved to entertain. And I thought, yes, doing something like that is much more people oriented and much more social, and that sounds like that's much more at my strata. So I took a course at what was then a higher national diploma in hotel catering and institutional management, is what it was called back in the day at what's now called Oxford Brookes University, which was then Oxford Polytechnic. And and I loved it. I loved being in that kind of hospitality milieu. That was really ticking all of my boxes. So I had to go into industry as part of that course. And I came back to Guernsey, where I grew up, this tiny island, 7x9, which is absolutely magical. And went back there, worked in hotels there, and then got itchy feet and thought, I'm off. I want to go traveling. So I put an orange rucksack on my back. This was in 1979 now.
That's quite unusual, isn't it? Because obviously that would have been bucking a trend, because you were expected to just get married and have kids and definitely not pack a bag. And how did you end up even having the confidence to do that?
I think it was naivety. I think if I knew what the big bad world was all about, I could never have gone. I think I was just utterly naive. And of course, as you rightly said earlier on, no internet, no Google, no nothing, no Amazon where you could buy books. You had to go to the library and have a look at places and travel, whatever. So I opened this big old atlas we had at home, and I just drew a line from little old Guernsey all the way to all the places that I'd heard of. So all through Europe, down the east coast, well, Israel, down the east coast of Africa, across to India, up to Nepal, down through Thailand and Malaysia to Indonesia and to Australia, furthest point I could get to. Drew a line and worked my socks off. I had three jobs at the time and got £650, and that was it. That was my ticket and my spending money. And I took off. I just took off.
600. There'll be loads of youngsters listening right now going, you went traveling with £600. Like, basically, that would probably get you to two locations if you're lucky.
Nowadays.
That was traveling when it was, I suppose, authentic. Do you know what I mean? It would have been a completely different experience to what it is today.
Really? Yeah, it really absolutely was. And they were well-worn trails, particularly the ones through, well, down that east coast of Africa, down the Nile, for example, but also through India. There were a lot of young travellers doing that same sort of thing. So I was never really on my own. I always found myself with groups of other travellers in hostels, and sometimes I'd come across them again in a month or so's time in another country. But what was beautiful, Cherise, at that time, I just bought an open ticket. So I just bought all the locations and I could come and go as I pleased. So I stayed in places until I thought, I've seen enough of that, I need to move on now. And off I went. But it wasn't trouble-free. I very often found myself in little scrapes. I did run out of money. I did have to sleep on the beach a few times. I did have to sell clothing to get food. I did end up in Nepal where they closed the country down. They only had electricity once every other day. And I lived on one pie every other day because that's all I could afford because I was stuck there. And I got to Australia with $25. That's all I had in the whole world.
Gosh.
$25. So I had to quickly get a job. And I was very lucky. I got a job as a relief assistant manager at the Sheraton in Perth for a while. And then after that, I moved to Sydney and I worked in Sydney for a few months as well. I went to New Zealand for 4 months. So it was a wonderful experience.
Perth must have been. So when I went traveling, it's like, I've just realized, I've just said that out loud, like going traveling with 600 quid. I went traveling with 700. I lied about how much money I had in the bank to go to Australia. And I went to Perth as well. So the Perth that you saw, and obviously it would have been loads more built up by the time I got there, you know, and Perth is, you know, as far as Australia's concerned, it's still the Wild West. You know, it must have been incredible to be there. Was there anything there? Like, it probably wasn't very good back then.
Well, there was the Sheraton Hotel where I worked. There was the Swan River. There was the beautiful King's Park. Yeah. Lots of blue sky, lots of kookaburras and all that sort of stuff. But a lot of open countryside and vineyards as well, obviously down in the south. It was a sleepy town, really. I mean, the nearest town to Perth is Singapore, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
So it is very remote. So, you know, and it is now 50 years ago, isn't it? So 75, yeah. So it's a long, half a century ago. So it has changed enormously, as Sydney has. I haven't been to Australia in about 4 years, but even then, Sydney seemed like a kind of teeming metropolis to me because I grew up in a tiny island, 7 miles by 9 miles. So anything was big to me. So it was an extraordinary experience.
And what did your family think about you doing what you did? Like, were they pat you on the back, so, you know, it's amazing? Or was mum a bit scared? Like,
sure, she was a bit scared. I'm sure she was, but she was wonderful in that she always said, which is what I say to my boys, you know, I want you to be happy. So go and follow your bliss, really. My father was then living out in the United Arab Emirates, and I didn't have a close relationship with him, so I didn't really look to him for counsel. But my mum just wanted me to be happy. And so, yeah, so off I went. And actually, my sister was a pioneer, really, for us, I suppose, because she'd gone 2 years before and had gone off to New Zealand, but she'd gone across land, but she'd done South America. I didn't do that route. She'd done a different route. But no, we both had kind of wandering spirits. This is my twin sister, who also worked in yachts for many years.
No way! I didn't know you had a twin sister. Yeah. And also an adventurer as well.
Yes, yes. It's funny. We're identical twins, but we're very different in character. So yes, we're adventurous, but she's very much more, well, we're completely different. We have different outlooks on life. She's very family oriented. She's a fabulous gardener. She likes to do things by the book. I'm always colouring outside the lines. If I can bucket systems, where that's me. So we have come to blows about that at times when we don't see eye to eye. But we, you know, as we grow older, we do accept each other a lot more. But we are incredibly different. To say that we came from the same egg, you know, we are incredibly different as people, as personalities.
So when did your yachting story start? After all of these other incredible adventures, like you're off to a flying start as it is, like it now doesn't make it feel like yachting would be that strange.
Yeah, well, it was adventurous. But what happened was my mother got remarried. And so I was still in Australia. So she got remarried. So I flew back for the wedding, at which point my twin sister had just started working on a yacht in Antibes with her then boyfriend, whose sister and brother-in-law were captain and chef on what was a relatively big boat. I think it was about 30 meters back in the day. And so once we'd been to the wedding, my sister and I, so she came in from France. Antibes she was, and I came in from Australia. She said, "You must come down to France and see what I'm doing. I'm working on a yacht." And I was going, I knew she was working on a yacht. I had no idea what it meant. I had never heard of the yachting industry. So I said, yeah, great, let's go. We can ski. I'd never skied by then. And so I went down and I discovered the yachting industry. And I was going back to my job in Australia, in Sydney, but I was offered a job on a boat. And I thought, why not? That was 1982. That was now 1982. So that's when my yachting career started. So, yeah. Oh,
that's quite, I mean, I imagine the yachts were a different size back then. They weren't like what they are now.
No. I mean, Kingdom was on the horizon. She was then called Nabila. So that was Khashoggi's yacht. And then she became, of course, Trump Princess and various other things. So she was the big yacht in Antibes. But apart from that, there was nothing more than 40 meters, I would say, if that, 35, 40 meters. So the IYCA didn't exist. It was the Port Vauban, and that's where all the big boats were. But we didn't have the Millionaire's Quay or what's now called the Billionaire's Quay. That's all completely new. So yes, yachts were tiny. I mean, nowadays I train on yachts that are 120 odd meters long, and that's completely different dynamic in so many ways. Change is enormous.
I think the size has had an impact, you know, and I think a lot of the stuff that's going on in the yachting world at the moment, let's say we're going through a growth spurt. It's kind of a little bit uncomfortable, but we're obviously in a lot of areas of the industry, what we've been doing for so long is not adequate and it's not serving. I think that's probably a fair shout, but it is driven by the size. You can't function, you know, the running operation of a 40 meter to 150 meters. It's vastly, vastly different. And you can't probably get away with as much either. Do you know what I mean? Like 40s. You know, you can not go a bit looser, but do you know what I mean? You can get away with a lot more because it's not, you know, I mean, the budgets on some of the larger boats, you know, that in itself would scare the crap out of me if I was chief steward. Yeah.
It's a necessary change. We have, you know, captains today working on captaining 120 odd meter yachts. That's like running a small corporation. That when you've got up to 60, 65 crew, albeit some on rotation, that's a lot of people to manage. You know, and I'm going to quote Captain Kelly here. I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember exactly what she says, but she says that 90% of what the captains do, they're not trained for. 10% they're trained for, all the technical stuff, you know, the navigation and the running of the vessel per se, but the people management, which is the huge part of the job, is what you're not necessarily trained to do. And I think that's where one of the biggest sticking points is in yachting today. When you get poor leadership, I mean, there are some fabulous captains, and I've worked on boats which are beautifully run, and I have worked on boats which are horrendously run, and it trickles down, and are not managing the boat properly. Everybody gets away with everything. And then it's a whole viper's nest of stuff that's not going to go right. Heads of department are not behaving correctly because they're getting away with not doing the right things. Compliance isn't followed. Rules aren't followed. Budgets aren't followed. Backhanders are taken. The whole thing just becomes really toxic. So that is one of the big things that really has to kick into the industry now with these larger yachts, is that proper leadership programs have to be followed right from the get-go, not just captains, but every head of department, anybody leading anybody else needs to know how to lead themselves first, and then they can lead other people. Because when you don't know who you are, you don't have a strong mindset, you're struggling with your own leadership skills, you can't hope to lead anybody else, because you're on the back foot. And I see it with many chief stewardesses, that out of their depth, if they haven't had good training, they want to
life experience.
Yes,
I would argue life experience. I mean, we'll just go. So at 82, 1980, you're in the yachting world. Can you think back what your first impressions were? You know, being around these yachts, that wealth. Can you remember what resonated with you at the time?
You know, it seems like small fry nowadays, because now when you're talking about, you know, the owners of Google or WhatsApp or Amazon or other people in that, they're all multi-billionaires. Back in the day, we were talking about millionaires, and, you know, probably if it was talking about European money, it's old money. If we were talking about Arabs, then they were inherently wealthy, because obviously the growth of the United Arab Emirates was starting to happen then. So it was very different. So did we have wealthy people that came on board? Yes, we did. Probably not so many people that you'd know about, not pop stars and film stars.
And
not
old money, but you wouldn't know who they were.
Old money, yeah. I mean, I do remember being on a yacht working out in off Agadir off Mustique between two charters, and I did see David Bowie and Mick Jagger on the island, and then Princess Margaret, the former Queen's sister, came on board the yacht I was working on. I had to show her around, and that was wonderful. That's a great memory. So, you know, people like that, old money, but not the new money. And I think that's something else that's making a difference in the industry now. And I was very interested to hear that perspective at Metz last November. There is a whole new generation of yacht owners now. So younger generations of yacht owners are really going to use their boats in different ways. They're going to use their boats in ways where they need extraordinary experiences. They probably want the crew to be more involved in their experiences, to bring a fun element to as well. Whereas you wouldn't get that so much with old money. It's very much upstairs, downstairs.
Well, yeah, it was, you know, it's like back in the day, you know, even the training that I went through, very structured, like you would in a, you know, an English stately home, you know, that kind of, you are, you know, you're not really heard or seen. The standard of service on land obviously was brought onto boats in the beginning. But like you said, it was very, you're not seen. You know, one of the first boats I ever worked on, we would, you know, we would go into cabins and they, you know, the chief steward would make sure that we weren't seen when we were ducking back down to check their cabin because the guests had just come back. Do you know what I mean? It was hiding. You know, behind doors, they don't want you to, you want to fit, like I said, if you were doing well, they didn't even know that you were there you know what I mean? It was kind of a bit invisible, but you can't give like you said, you can't give this new generation of experience. But also I think how we interact as a society is up for review as well. With this avalanche of information and stuff like that, the buzzword of authentic experience, you need to be involved to kind of create that kind of connection, that kind of experience. It's not just your invisible type thing. I mean, they do still obviously probably still function that way, but everything's up for debate and change at the moment, I think. Not only in this industry.
Can I just go back to that? Because you made a really important point there. I think when we're thinking about service and the difference between service back in the day, if you like, and even 10 or 20 or 30 years ago and today, is that I think, and I hope, because this is the way I teach, is that the service that you're giving can only be as good as the service that the guest is receiving. So you can't say, oh, we're all going to, you know, stand in our uniforms all stiff with our white gloves on and we're all going to walk out together like penguins and put the food down and all of that, which technically might be very correct. But you've got a lot of guests nowadays that do not want that sort of service. They want discreet service, but they want it, and they want to have their yachts feel like a second home. They don't want stiff staff around them. They want this seamless service. So in a department like housekeeping, for example, it can still very much be an invisible service or what's called ghost service. Same in private homes or in palaces or those sort of establishments. It is very much an unseen service. But I found that you get different, especially in the so larger yachts, obviously it's much more delineated. So you would have housekeeping staff who won't do any service. On the smaller yachts, say up to about 60 meters, the stewardesses will do everything. When you get to 80, 90 plus, it's much more, you're either working in service or you're working in housekeeping. So the characters, I think, personality types that towards housekeeping are much more on the introverted side. So they love to give service and operations and do a really good job, but they don't want to be seen. They don't want to be the people facing members of the crew. The stewardesses much more need to have people contact. And so they wouldn't function well if they had to be, you know, behind the scenes all the time because they would miss that people contact. But the housekeepers like that. They like the fact that they can escape to the housekeeping or laundry. Terribly practical, very good at putting processes in place, but don't need to be up front and center. So in those situations, it is relevant. But what we've Absolutely. And the way I teach nowadays is it's to be incredibly flexible, particularly if you're working on a charter yacht. It's different if you're working on an owner-only boat, because you get to know the owner and their inner circle and their guests and their habits and whatever. But when you've got guests in front of you that you don't know, and you've got to make those assessments pretty quickly in order to give them a really good time from the get-go. So you're observing them, you're observing their habits, you're watching the dynamic of the group. You're taking in everything, but you're adapting your style of service to them, not what you think is right. How are they going to have the best experience? And that's what you have to do. So if they like, chuck all the food on the table, let us help ourselves, we'll ring the bell if we need you, don't come and disturb us. That's good service for them.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I like you said, it's more, I suppose everything's got to be more flexible, you know, more tailored. Whereas before it was quite a rigid training program. And I suppose what they would expect, again, like I said, going back to like the stately homes and stuff like that, there's the difference between old money and new money as well. And obviously now we're in different generations of old money anyway. It's changed massively. I suppose I've never really thought about it, but when you get onto larger boats, having the opportunity to split like that, I don't, obviously on bridge, they don't get that opportunity, that if you are a certain type of personality, it doesn't really lend itself the same way that the interior can. So you can't be a person behind the scenes, you know, obviously with supporting the housekeeping side, or you could be front facing. Whereas on, in the bridge and stuff like that, they don't have that possibility. And I think maybe that might lend, one of the things that I've talked about in other podcasts is going back to what you said about leadership. There are a lot of people that are in leadership positions because there's nowhere else to go in the journey that shouldn't be leaders. They're not naturally inclined leaders or people managers, but they end up being in that position, even though if they were on land in a bigger, you know, in a bigger entity, they would never probably end up being in that. There would be other options for them. Coupled with the lack of training, I think makes that perfect cocktail for problems on board.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And I think that, you know, something else to layer in on that is a lot of people stay in the industry because they can't think of anything else to do. I'd like to leave, but I'll never earn this money, or I'll never do this, I'll never do that. It's so important to have a sense of purpose. So with an interior crew member, for example, I don't think there are many young stewardesses that go on board a super yacht because they want to be the best at polishing silver or serving food or cleaning toilets. So you've got to find a purpose greater than that. If you're a chef on board, you're going because you love cooking, you love food, you love working with different food elements, you love creating menus, you like traveling to different places and using all those ingredients. So you're in your purpose. It's very much the same with engineering. You choose engineering because you love the technical side of it, the electrical side of it, the whatever else, IT, AV, IT, whatever it might be, you've got a passion for it. Maybe deck crew have a passion for the sea, a female or male. So they're looking towards a passion and a purpose. When I train nowadays, I always start my training courses. I don't care what I'm teaching, because the technical stuff will count for nothing if you don't know your sense of purpose. If you haven't got a strong mindset, you don't know your values, you don't know your goals, you don't know your crew members well enough, you don't know who you are, you don't know you know what your trigger points are, but how do you manage them? How do you build resilience? I always teach that first, even if it's only a little half day self-awareness program, and then layer on the technical skills. Because I can teach you how to lead. It's so many, a lot of people can teach people how to set tables, make beds, clean a boat, but you know, whatever it might take. There is obviously fantastic skills required in that as well. But if you are hating the work you're doing and you don't know really why you're doing it, so you just want some money, then you know, you're not living your best life. If you have a sense of purpose, and when things get really tough, you can go back to that purpose and say, this is why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I want to feel freedom. I want to buy my own business. I want to have my own home. I want to travel the world. I want to support my family. Whatever that is, you've got to have that really clear in your mind so that you can fall back on that.
Yeah. I mean, having a purpose and a drive really helps. You know, like I lived in New Zealand with a bunch of hippies for a bit. So, you know, I lived with the great unwashed for ages, and I really embraced that lifestyle. And I just remember going, I want the other end of the spectrum. I want to know what it's like to be around, well, you know, like I've been around people that are very frugal, grow their own food, like the other end of the spectrum kind of thing. But I loved service. I love pulling, you know, it's one of those things that I've taken away now. Like I like pulling off a really nice dinner party, you know, I got addicted to the buzz, you know, the more you, I liked it. Making people feel good as well. I think that's one of the main things. You are there on their holiday. They are, you know, they want to feel good. They want to have, you know, obviously have an experience. And I, you know, I love the buzz. You know, if you polish it off and you manage to get that at the end.
For sure. And that's exactly what it's all about. Because what are you doing? You're creating things that money can't buy, because they can have the super yachts and the fast cars and the beautiful homes and everything else. You're creating experiences, all of this intangible stuff that they're going to go away with. And when you make them feel good, it makes you feel good. It's a win-win situation. And if you go into the kind of biochemical ramifications of that, it's boosting your immune system. You've got these happy hormones going around. Your posture is better. Your diaphragm's working better. So your internal organs are being massaged in a better way. If you're like this, oh my God, not another charter. Oh, I wish we had the boat to us. All of this stuff, it's not good. But when you're giving good service, it feels so good. It's
We obviously, because we, you know, I always talk about things from a female perspective. You know, looking back when you started in the industry, what would you say the main differences are for women on board now to when, you know, back, you know, you're talking about the early mid 80s? What were they facing then? Has it really changed?
I think we were facing the same sort of things that the girls today are facing, but in a much smaller, kind of much more scaled down. But our generation processed it all in a different way. So if somebody, if say, for example, I was working and somebody pinched my bum or something, I wouldn't say, oh, sexual harassment. I'd probably just giggle and I wouldn't have any more thoughts about it. I would just manage it in a different way. So I think there are a lot of things that come into play. I think it's, yes.
Would you say that, sorry, but would you say that, because I've obviously contemplated this a lot and we've just done the survey and stuff like this. I've contemplated this because obviously your generation, my generation, we probably experience a form of sexual harassment the time.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
It's not that you were accepting it, but if you reacted to every single time, you would never be able to live your life.
That's right.
Because, do you know what I mean? It's that, I suppose there is a resilience to it, that you are kind of accepting a level of it, but you can't give it that headspace because you just would not get on and do anything. You kind of have to stonewall it a little bit, that is it worth you reacting to, kicking off about, do you know what I mean? Would you agree?
I totally agree. And I think, you know, sometimes it's really difficult to process these thoughts when you're super tired. You've been working, you know, 90 days nonstop, 16 hours a day or whatever it might be. And I've done that. So that's why I pulled out that quote, because I've done that. And you get tired and you are less resilient. But it's very true to say that the more you focus on the negativity or the more you focus on anything, the more it's going to grow in your consciousness. Yeah. So it's really important to rationalize things and not let them get out of perspective. So what was the intention of the deckhand who pinched my butt, for example? I'm using that as a, you know, throwaway comment. It was probably just to make me laugh, or it was probably just a friendly, funny thing. Was it intention to sexually harass me? No. So if I wanted to make it that, I could make it that, particularly in my head, and I'd go down this kind of rabbit hole, or I could deal with it in a different way. And if I felt it was inappropriate, I'd say, that's inappropriate.
Yeah. I think one of the things, obviously, talking about female experiences and stuff like that, I think we will have to find a bit of a middle ground with it, because it will be exhausting. You know, let's be really frank and honest. Women have been treated badly for a very long time. We're probably in the best place that we've ever been, but we're more outspoken now than we've ever been. We're in this kind of weird environment at the moment where, you know, we are getting to a point where we can report things and everything else. But it's like you said, putting it, I'm not trying to say that you need to accept it.
No.
But it's, you can't, you just, I just don't, it's just exhausting to react to everything all of the time. You know, just kind of look at it, assess it, do it, like you said, does it come from a place which creates a vulnerability? Is it just a bit crass? Do I have the time capacity to kind of put that into my life? Because men will continue to, I don't think men are ever going to stop. It might change behavior slightly, but I can't see things stopping ever.
No, yeah, it's maybe partly human nature as well. And it's not just the girls get harassed on board, the poor boys do as well. But I think it's really important to empower people with proper training about resilience, mindset, values, all of that sort of stuff, and get their heads really strong before they go into what can be a pretty challenging industry, the superyacht industry. Yes, it has its glamour, but of course there is an underbelly. There's an underbelly in the film industry, in the music industry, in the fashion industry. Anywhere where there's wealth and power, you're going to get an underbelly. And we have it in the superyacht industry. We need to be able to manage it as best we can. Is it going to stop overnight? No, but we do have to take
stop ever.
maybe never, because of the genre of people that we have who are owning yachts, and I'm not going to say managing yachts, but people who own yachts.
No, but there's also a problem now with dating. You obviously then you get the opposite. You go too hard, and now guys are not sure about speaking to girls. So you've got to be careful. Because what is the mating game, I suppose, and what is harassment? Do you know what I mean? There is this, the grey area is you will get. Guys that find you attractive will approach you. How you deal with that, and you won't always find them attractive. But then you don't want to just stop guys approaching you, because then that's, the other extreme. But I think wider society is now looking at this. Western women have got, we are living in the glory of what the women before us have created. But we've now got to start making decisions. My generation, we were told that we could have it all. You could have a career and you can have kids and all of that. That's not technically true. There will be compromises, and just make sure you're not compromising the wrong thing at the wrong time. So I think there's a lot that we, as women, we've got the power, we can reflect on and make some decisions.
That's the important thing, is reflection and making good decisions, i.e. good choices in your life, based on good information. So don't feed yourself with false information. In other words, conjuring up things that aren't really happening, because you're feeding yourself with kind of toxic thoughts of, oh, everyone is bad. If I work on a yacht, I'm going to get harassed. It's not necessarily the case at all. You could have an amazing career on yachts and really enjoy it and never be harassed and just have fun.
No, I mean, I know countless women, I've all had amazing. We heard from survey itself, women saying that, the industry is fantastic, I never had a problem.
Yes.
That's great. As far as I'm concerned, that's fabulous. But the women do have a vulnerability on board that we need to look at. And I think the changes in training, when you started training, what did you use as your guide? Because this is before any kind of guidelines existed.
Yeah, exactly. So back in 2002, John Wyborn, who's still the training director of Blue Water Yachting and wears many other hats in the industry, is actually my unsung hero, because he does so much for the industry that he should be, well, I'm sure he is recognized. I feel like he should have some sort of fantastic award for everything he does. But he asked me to, I was working in crew recruitment for him, and he'd just lost his interior trainer and asked me if I'd like to do some interior training. Now, I had actually done some training in the catering industry back in Guernsey, and I thought, yes, why not? Sounds really interesting. So I wrote courses which were then accredited by the PYA, or certified rather, certified by the PYA. And so there were introduction to interior courses. Did I have an intermediate course? I can't remember. And then advanced courses. And what I discovered then was that the young girls that were coming through into the advanced courses had, as you alluded to earlier, no life experience, no work experience, or they'd done a couple of seasons on a boat and now they wanted to be chief. No idea of management skills or leadership skills. And I said to John, I think we need to bring some personal development learning into these courses. And he said, yep, that sounds like a good idea. This was in May or something. And so I took myself off to London and I took some kind of philosophy courses and leadership courses and that sort of stuff, and came back in September, and then went right down the self-development rabbit hole, which I've been in really for about 30 years. But anyway, fast forward to think it was about 2012 or something when the guest program was created. Then a group of trainers from around the world just got together. It's the brainchild of Joey Mean, who's absolutely amazing and is still driving that forward today. So a group of trainers from around the world, New Zealand, Australia, America, and Europe. England was then part of Europe, was it? I think, yes, since 2000. We all got together and decided what would be the best courses to have as a career path through the industry for interior crew, because at that time they just weren't being recognized. Oh, it's only making beds and cleaning toilets, you know, anybody can do that. And of course, it's so much more technical than that, and it involves a lot of people skills as well. So in recognition of that, we then created the guest program, which at the time was Guidelines for Unified Excellence in Service Training. Because it has now expanded, fast forward a decade, to, you know, now we have DEC courses, AVIT courses, YORP, which is the Yacht Owner Representative Program courses, the PERSA courses, there are others, and everything related to interior. So it's now Guidelines for Unified Excellence in Super Yacht Training. And it's an enormous program, and I think more than 40 training schools across the world. So it's been a very successful program. It still needs more recognition than it's getting, but it's much more than it has been in the past.
So the guest program still fights against the fact that there is no requirement. Obviously, Bridge, we've said this countless times, the path to Bridge has lots of requirement for you to take on roles.
Yeah.
But the interior, again, and I've spoken to this tonight, doesn't actually have a requirement. Do you think that's kind of, is that a help or a hindrance? Because obviously there is a flexibility with what you could create. But ultimately, if there's no basic requirement, I mean, I've mentioned it, and when I spoke to Paul from Chirp, you know, we discussed like minimum manning regulations and stuff like that, and the interior doesn't exist, which is ironic, considering that the interior controls probably, I would say, 70% of the guest experience, which is the main reason we're all working in the first place.
Yeah. But just to counter that slightly, now if you get a certificate, a COC, a certificate of competency through the guest program, in other words, you do all the required modules in either introductory or intermediate or advanced courses, so you've got this COC, that qualification can go towards minimum requirements, manning requirements. So if you've got a chief stewardess on board or a stewardess on board who has a full COC, that can go towards minimum manning. And so a yacht could, for example, leave a port with the proper requirements, which it may not have if they hadn't taken that into account. But is it a hindrance or a help? It's been a huge hindrance because obviously it's been such a hard sell. And there are a lot of people who say, oh, it's just a waste of time. It's only trainers making money. Can I tell you how hard it is to make money out of running training courses, particularly if you've got a school? I don't have a school. I do mostly onboard training. But if you've got a school and you've got all the overheads, and then if you live in France, as I do, you give 25.6% of your salary to, or your earnings to, the French government before you pay any tax. It's not an easy thing to do. I find it hugely enjoyable, but it's not an easy way to make money, that's for sure. But it has to be, for me, it has to be taken on as a responsibility. If it's not going to be mandatory, the MCA are probably never going to make it mandatory, even if they brought in a lot more safety elements into the courses. I still don't think it's going to be mandatory for a long while. It would be wonderful if it was, but it has to be industry driven in that case. So crew recruiters have got to say, have you got a guest program qualification? Managers need to be saying the same thing. Captains need to be saying the same thing. You would never go to a 5-star hotel. Say, for example, you or I booked a room at a 5, 6, or 7-star hotel. We wouldn't go in there thinking, I wonder if the staff are trained. We would have the expectation that they were trained to a 5, 6, or 7-star level. We just would, because we'd be paying vast amounts of money. Now, when you get guests that are paying $3.5 million a week on some of these yachts, or anything from $500,000 to $3.5 or $5 million a week to be on a yacht, their crew should be trained. Their interior crew should be trained. They should know what they're doing at a very high level. It's ridiculous to think that they're not getting the proper training. How can they possibly maintain and look after the investment of a yacht owner when they don't know how to properly look after silk wall finishings or bamboo carpets or gold plated, whatever it might be, and all the new materials that are coming out now? You can cause hundreds of thousands worth of pounds worth or dollars or euros worth of damage in 5 minutes if you don't know what you're doing. You really can. So it's, for me, it's a no-brainer. But it has to now be industry driven if we're not going to get it mandatory.
There's some fabulous stories as well, you know, like people using scouring pads on Christoffel cutlery, and you're just like glassware, you know, scouring pads in showers and annihilating the showers, you know, like just stuff that, you know, is just crazy. It's just, you know, you wouldn't go to the Savoy or Claridge's in London and, you know, be served by someone that hasn't done a course, but you can on a boat. And we're supposed to be at their level. It's, I suppose, in a way, it's a bit embarrassing.
Well, it's our responsibility. So as trainers, we're doing as much as we can. For any of the crew agents who are pushing the guest course, and thank you to those of you who do, it's wonderful. But yes, it's not a young stewardess's fault if she's not taught properly or given the right products to clean with or shown how to use the washing machine properly with whatever products. She shouldn't be put in those positions. She should be trained. The problem is, oh, let's not do training. We can do it all in-house. The chief stewardess can teach them how to do things. Where's the chief stewardess learned it? Because she could have learned all her skills from another chief stewardess who learned from another chief stewardess who wasn't doing the right thing either.
I mean, I would argue that's, you know, like we said, the lack of regulation when it comes to the interior, I think, does us a disservice because it doesn't instill importance, which instills value. And I think it all kind of stems from there. And then you add to the fact, so I've said this many times, your interior crew can be a lot younger than bridge. You know, you can have a 60-year-old captain, a 40-year-old first, 30-year-old second, but your chief stew is 26 years old. And she could have got to where she was because she's super, you know, don't get me wrong, you could be super smart and you can learn on the job, no problem at all. You know, obviously with the help of the internet now, it's probably never been so easy to be self-taught, but you can only get so far. And that's probably only learning the practical parts of the trade. That's not learning what we mentioned earlier. Leadership. Human management is the biggest part. Getting your team, getting the best out of your team is not the same as knowing what you can do with silk ball hangings. It's a completely different set of skills. And you can Google it, but it's not going to work.
No. And that comes from life skills. So, you know, you at a 26-year-old, when I look back at myself at 26, was I managing a team? Yes, I was, but it was much smaller boats. Would I have liked to have managed a team on a 80, 90 meter when I was 26, even though I had a degree in hotel management under my belt and had worked before I went into the industry and had traveled, so I had life experience, I still wouldn't have wanted to do it. I was a completely different person when I was 36 from when I was 26. I was different again at 46 because by then I'd had children. So, you know, at 56 or 60, I would be a completely different chief stewardess in each of those decades, because I'd had different life experiences and I would certainly be much more tolerant than I was back in my 20s. When I was 26, it was like my way or the highway. Terrible.
I haven't got any recent data on the average because obviously the boat size, like you just pointed out, the boat size, you're going to want a chief stew that is very seasoned, very experienced to take on a role of chief stew on a 90 metre. But that also then clashes with the female experience, because at 35, you're starting to think about, I want a baby.
Yeah.
And the industry is hostile. I wouldn't say it is hostile. If you want a baby, you're out. That's it. You're done. That I have only heard of two people that have, you know, just managed to be on a smaller vessel, very understanding owner, captain, but the larger vessel's not a hope.
No, but it's inherently incompatible. It really is. I mean, you know, we've got very many young Filipinos working on board whose families are looking after their children. That's a cultural thing. That's a very normal thing to happen. If you go to Hong Kong or Singapore and you see all the Filipino workers there, all of their children are all being looked after by families. That's a cultural thing. In Europe, we don't operate in the same way. There are very few European women that I know, or English women, or Americans, or Australians, or New Zealanders that would have babies and leave them at home to be looked after by their parents or other members of the family. It doesn't happen in those cultures. So it's inherently incompatible. So it's not just that the industry is opposed to it, it just doesn't work. And I don't think the women would want to do it. I think they would say, I either want to have babies or I want to go stay on the boat.
Well, but you get into a bind, don't you, really? It's like, I'm going to leave peak of my game, you know, best salary ever, but I have to, if you want a family, you have to choose between one of the... I would also argue that the industry is quite hostile to older females anyway. They know that they need the experience on board, but they are addicted to the glossy youngster. Do you know what I mean? They want young, attractive girls. Let's not get it twisted. And there is definitely a place for them. But again, with chasing this, that kind of image, unfortunately, when it comes to management and people management and everything else, the power dynamic for females will always be skewed.
Yeah. And that's often driven by the owners who want, you know, nice looking people around them. And that's fair enough, as long as they're competent and well trained. But, you know, I think it's wrong to think that your life is over once you leave a yacht. So even if you left a yacht at 40, say I was 38 when I left yachts, I was 40 when I had my first child and 42 when I had my second child. And I've had the most incredible career outside of working on a yacht. So I did go back to being crew between 2017 and 2021, which I absolutely loved, by which time I was in my 60s, and I loved it. That was a seasonal job, and that taught me a lot about what had happened in the 20 years that I had been shore-based. But there are so many transferable skills that you get when working on any part of the yacht, but in the interior we're talking about. So you can take those to other and build your own businesses, and it's not that you won't earn as much money as you do on board, because you can, as long as you're doing something you love and which is successful and innovative and giving good service in some way. So I think it's a myopic way of thinking about whether you should move ashore or not, because there is always something you can do. And frankly, it's not a huge sacrifice to move ashore to have a family. It's a wonderful thing. It's a gift to be able to have a family. As you know, as a mother, and I know as a mother, you wouldn't change it for anything in the world. And there are, of course, you know, there's a juxtaposition. You do have an element of freedom on board you do have an element of freedom, and the money gives you financial freedom, but you are also very restricted in your lifestyle. Luckily now we have a lot more jobs that are rotational, so you can at least have half your life where you've got full freedom and the other half where you're on board and hopefully doing work that you love. But, you know, you can still create a really beautiful life for yourself off, you know, when you leave a boat. Right.
I mean, you're not going to regret having children. They're like, especially after being able to live your life, you know, yachting, traveling and stuff like that, you know, it is, you know, they are tiring, but they're cute.
100%.
They are really cute.
Yeah, 100%.
And yeah, you won't ever regret it. Has it helped? Because obviously now, you know, like you said, where we are today, there are a ton of different initiatives. I mean, didn't even exist when I started Yacht Pearls of Wisdom, that are going on, like, to try and bring collaboration to start looking at some of the issues. And I know you're part of the Super Yacht Alliance.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't know if everybody knows what the Super Yacht Alliance is, but essentially it's a non-profit organization which is based in Malta, which was founded by NEBA, Mediterranean Yacht Brokers Association, CBAS, can't remember what that stands for, but Super Yacht Builders Association, and IAMI, International Association of Maritime Accreditation, I think that is, which is the body that certifies all of the guest courses. So those three associations came together with the view of elevating yacht standards. So promoting collaboration and enhancing kind of professional images. And within that association, once it was formed, other people like, for the Alliance also unites different associations like the PYA, ICOMIA, EBA, International Yacht Brokers Association. So those have all come together as well under a kind of common interest to raise professional standards in the industry. And within that, they invite different member associations to join Alliance think tanks or working groups. And within the Super Yacht Alliance, I think there are five think tanks. I'm part of three of them. And each of those think tanks are addressing different areas within the industry. So we have, for example, the wonderful Karen Passman, who created Raising the Bar some time ago. It was the first ever Super Yacht Alliance think tank. So that was created in 2021. That's all about That's all about crew retention. So how can we improve crew retention, crew welfare, careers in yachting, and kind of directing collaborative efforts towards that. So Karen chairs that. Then we have another think tank, which is called Changing Tack. And that was started by UKSA, so the UK Sailing Academy. And they've got members, their committee members are, so CHIRP, so you spoke to Paul from CHIRP, you said, the Seafarers Charity, Nautilus, and ICEONE. They're all part of the Changing Tack on Crew Welfare, CTCW, that's the second think tank. And then there's a third one, which is all about onboard safety operations, that I can't remember who. Yes, that's Paul. Now, that is Paul Shepherd from CHIRP who runs that. He chairs that think tank. And within that, no, I don't know. I don't know much about that one, actually. Then there's the crew workplace culture, which I'm a part of. So I'm part of the Raising the Bar one. I'm an ambassador for Raising the Bar. I think Karen does amazing work with that and has done for a long time. Then the crew workplace culture, which is chaired by Karine Rayson, who's the crew coach, and Caroline Blatter, who runs the Superyacht Services Guide. So those are the two chairs at that think tank. And that think tank has three different groups. So there's a independent reporting support and accountability group, there's a DPA role review group, and there's a crew safety climate group. So those three groups work within that work group. And then the last one is the Bridge Between, which is chaired by Kaylee Biddle from Hill Robinson, who was recently appointed the crew human resource manager at Hill Robinson, and she does an amazing job. And when you think of how competitive our industry can be, she has brought together different management companies to all work together, a group of yacht managers and crew employees from different companies, which focus on crew management employment, about the legislation and how that can be improved to improve the crew journey. So that's a hugely useful think tank as well. So those five groups within the Superyacht Alliance are doing magnificent work for the industry. So I think we can hope to see some really positive changes just through that one group.
Well, I think the change is that they're at least having the conversation, which wasn't being had. With there's definitely there's more hope now, I think, than ever that we can try and get change. Again, obviously I'm only thinking about from the female perspective, the lack of regulation, I think, is turning out to be a bit of a sticking point when protecting women at sea. I'm really, I've said many times, the forum last year was very encouraging. The conversation did seem to change. And then, we'll see what everybody can come up with for this November.
And ICEONE are doing amazing work with that. And Laura Beard, who was running, she was the project manager for ICEONE, has just left and handed over to Josie DeVries, she formed the Healthy Crew Coach. She's an ex-chief stewardess, and she's taken over the ICEONE, the new project manager at ICEONE. So she is now chairing that Changing Tack on Crew Welfare group. A lot of powerful females working very hard in the industry, and I'm sure we're going to see some really positive change. And the initiatives that you do, for example, your survey that you've just put out, all of this stuff is going to be hugely useful at upcoming shows like the Metz Forum in November in Amsterdam, like the Monaco Yacht Show, like these big gatherings where we get a lot of people together under one roof, the movers and shakers of the industry, to listen to the results of your survey and listen to the women who are really pushing things forward. It's not to say the men aren't as well. They are. People like Paul from CHIRP. Paul CHIRP is fantastic. And so it's not just the females, but actually when I look at the Superyacht Alliance, it's strongly driven by women.
Yeah, I think, but then I don't know, maybe we're a bit more open-minded. I don't know. There's definitely a lot of great male voices out there. And I think they got a lot of airtime last forum, which I think really changed the mood. So it's all there. I mean, it's a bit like women are just a bit more proactive, right? Let's get on with it. Let's, this needs changing. Well, let's just change it then, thing.
And I think you're right. And I think, and I hugely appreciate the men in the industry and what the wonderful we do too. What I noticed when we went to the keynote conference in Nice earlier this year was there was this fabulous collaborative kind of atmosphere when we went into breakout groups. the discussions around the table were fantastic. Nobody was trying to jump on somebody else's idea or shout somebody down. Or it's all about listening and communicating and come up with collaborative solutions, meeting people in the middle. It was a fantastically uplifting conference, and that was hugely rewarding. Really happy to be part of that. So yeah, I think we should feel very positive, you know, because we're not going to make change overnight, and we are driven by some very pretty intransigent factors, like we're not going to change yacht owners' perspectives overnight, particularly the old school yacht owners and certain cultures that, you know, I'm going to say it, you know, there are certain cultures that don't have a great regard for women who are yacht owners, and so that's not going to change. There are certain personalities that don't have great regard for women, but we also do have a new generation of yacht owners, the younger generation, in other words, the people in their 40s and 50s, you know, the WhatsApp, Google, the Amazon kind of owners. These people, I think, the new yacht owners can be catalysts in making change in the industry, because I think they... Yeah, I think they just have a different perspective on life.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, there's definitely a lot to be quite. If there's going to be a moment where we can kind of change things, I think it's coming. You know, it is a perfect alignment of a lot of different things.
It is.
Exciting times, for sure.
It is exciting. It's really exciting because the support is there. But I think, as you said earlier, Cherise, it's really important to find that balance. So there's wonderful support out there, counselling and iSwan, obviously, and the work that Nautilus does and the PWA does to support people in the industry, male and female. But what we've got to do as well is to empower people to build resilience, to change their mindsets about things, to really get into a healthy mindset and not go down these poor me rabbit holes and, oh, somebody else is going to have to sort it out, particularly with this new generation who seem to be less resilient than we were back in, you know, the baby boomers, for example, or even the previous generation, where we had to kind of work it out a little bit more ourselves because we didn't have internet, we didn't have Google to ask, we didn't have ChatGPT to ask to sort my life out. We really did have to kind of sit down and think about it or talk about it or come up with our own solutions. So we have to, I think, safeguard against giving too much support so that people aren't motivated to kind of sort things out themselves, because that's incredibly disempowering for that individual. So build the resilience, the help is there if you need it, but don't rely on it wholly. Really try to work things out and, you know, build some inner strength.
Those are a really good point, you know, that you have resilience. They've just got to believe that they can do it. I think that's probably, whereas probably your generation and mine, all we had was, well, a bit of naivety, a bit of a wing and a prayer, it'll be all right, probably.
100%. Yeah. Whereas, hello,
Houston
here. We waited.
Yeah, just, you know, cross fingers. I'm sure it'll be fine. Whereas maybe too much information is making them second guess themselves, whereas we just didn't have any second information. We were just like, oh, we'll just see what happens. But they are capable of doing it, and I think that's what we probably need to reiterate more is, you know, building resilience is just having a go, really, and having a go on it. I think that's a really nice point to kind of end on. If anybody's listening to this and you're on board, you can do it all with the right amount of training, the right amount of support. You're more resilient than you know.
My goodness, much more, much more. And you don't have to wait to get into a sticky situation to find it out. You can build resilience in everything you do. Just make good choices for yourselves. Make healthy choices. Yeah.
It's been beautiful talking to you, Lynn. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I feel like we could keep going for ages. We could go down a few different rabbit holes.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, maybe we'll touch base again after November, because I think November's going to be quite an interesting. This year, the final of this year, I think will be really good. And I'm actually quite excited about next year as well.
Yes.
Because then we might be starting to see some paths to action. But it's been really lovely for you to be on the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me today.
I've loved it, Cherise. And before we end, I would just want to say to any crew that are watching, please be encouraged to come to some of these yacht shows, because people like Kaylee Little and Emma Baggett and Joey Mean, they're doing a lot of work, and other people, sorry, Sharon Rose, I'm sorry, remember everybody, but a lot of people are doing a lot of work to get you guys in these yacht shows so that you have a voice. we want to keep your voice. So there'll be help for accommodation, or look out for it. And, you know, come along and get your voices heard.
Yeah. No, 100%. I know that they've got tickets available for crew at the Forum this year. You know, even if it's really last minute, if you can make it, your boat's not going anywhere, trips are cancelled, it's definitely worth coming and being a part of that time.
It is. You learn so much more about the industry than you ever thought existed. I'm still learning 40 odd years in the industry. I still learn so much from every Forum and every yacht show that I go to. Amazing speakers, new innovative programs happening. Just finding out what's happening in the industry. This is your industry, you guys that are working in it. You should know what the future holds. It's exciting.
Very exciting. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will obviously hopefully come back. Dear listener, if you've enjoyed this episode, there'll be more on the horizon. If you want to stalk the legend, which is Lynn Edwards, it's Phoenix Training. That she's got a lot going on, so definitely. And also, if you see her on the French Riviera, she's definitely worth buying a wine, and she'll tell you
her pearl
of wisdom for sure. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, listeners. Until next time, take care.
Thank you, Cherise.